From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump said he gave Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe a big hug when Abe arrived for a meeting at the White House this morning. The president said he just couldn't help it. And the two men just wrapped up a joint news conference in which they verbally hugged each other. Here's Prime Minister Abe through a translator.
Donald, President, you are excellent businessmen, but you have never been in the Congress or being a governor. You have not experienced being in the public office, but you have fought the uphill struggle and fight for more than a year in the election campaign to become a new president. And this is the dynamism of democracy.
The dynamism of democracy. Well, those remarks came at the end of a very busy week. In the seat of democracy, Washington, D.C., President Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, told people to buy Ivanka Trump's stuff. Now she's being counseled. And Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz says he will refer her for an ethics investigation. But he was excoriated by voters in Utah who asked why he hasn't investigated Donald Trump's finances.
And then you've got this tweet today from President Trump who called last night's appeals court decision against his travel bans disgraceful. So let's bring in our politics roundtable. Enrique Acevedo is Univision news anchor and correspondent who's reporting from Washington, D.C. for the first 100 days of the Trump administration. Hi, Enrique.
Hey, Peter.
And Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hey, Rick.
Great to be with you.
All right. So, look, it didn't seem like President Trump wanted to go there during this press conference, but right out of the gate, he was asked several questions about the court ruling last night that upheld the ban on his travel ban. Here he is.
So we'll be doing something very rapidly having to do with additional security for our country. You'll be seeing that sometime next week. In addition, we will continue to go through the court process, and ultimately, I have no doubt that we'll win that particular case.
Rick, how do you interpret that? Because a lot of legal scholars are saying the administration made some mistakes by rushing this travel ban through. Some have said he should just rewrite the order to make it work. And it sounds like, as of today, that actually may still be on the table.
I view that as a two-track strategy, a plan and a backup plan. The plan being to continue to keep this fight in courts, but keep in mind that key provisions of the order, even if it was upheld, would expire after 90 days. The clock is ticking on that. So the additional steps that they're saying will come in the coming week, I think, will be key, and that might be the chance for them to craft that backup plan and to tone down some of the language and some of the specifics in an order and find something that they think might have a better chance of passing legal muster.
Now, I want to ask you both.
You make a really good point,
go ahead,
Peter,
go ahead.
Because you think they would have learned their lesson on doing things very rapidly after what happened. And we'll see if there are some adjustments to the most controversial aspects of this executive order. But that means admitting mistakes, and this is not an administration, and it wasn't a campaign prone to do that.
Well, I want to ask you both, just before we move on to the so many events of this past week, about, you know, what we just saw, this the two leaders standing and making comments and then taking questions. You know, what did you hear there? Enrique, start with you. We heard President Trump saying, we're going to have additional security for our country. You'll be seeing that sometime next week. Both of the leaders talked about how security was so important to them, but you could hear Abe also saying, I want my country to be able to build great things for your country. And the backdrop of that, of course, is that Donald Trump has said he wants America first, you know, American builders first. So what did you hear in this meeting of these two world leaders?
I think both leaders were also talking to China during this joint press conference. It's in their best interest, both Japan and the United States, that China gets the message in terms of what they want to do in security, the trade relationship that Japan and the U.S. have. So I think there was a lot of that. They were not only talking to the audience at the White House and people listening, but also to the Chinese government.
Free use of the seas. They were, you know, free travel on the seas.
Free navigation. Yeah.
Rick Klein?
There are obviously very tense and interesting conversations going on behind the scenes about security arrangements and a lot of pressure that Donald Trump is putting on the Japanese to increase their investment in security. I think all of that will be developed over time, and this meeting may be the first of that. I am struck by how the two leaders are trying to show this degree of mutual respect right now, and it is a tense time with a lot of the world trying to figure out what President Trump is really all about.
Rick, there is so much to talk about. We're just 3 weeks into this administration. We've also got this news out today about National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and some reporting showing that he had privately discussed lifting Russian sanctions with the Russian ambassador before the Trump administration took office. Now, this brings Vice President Mike Pence into the fray because he had defended Michael Flynn at some point. This is an awkward situation for him, to say the least. How serious are these? Is this reporting?
And many tentacles to this story. And you start with the fact that it's illegal under a two-century-old federal law that's rarely been enforced for anyone to negotiate with a foreign power unless they're explicitly given that right. You don't have two presidents at a time is the gist of it. And right now it looks as if General Flynn, in his position in the transition, was negotiating some kind of a deal or discussing the possibility of that. And that would stand – this brings us to the second big tentacle here, because that would stand at odds from the public posture. Mm-hmm. Which would mean that it's possible that General Flynn was misleading Vice President Pence, White House officials, about the nature of those conversations, because they went out to bat for him and said that it wasn't the way it had been described. So I'm really interested to see how this breaks down. Donald Trump was not asked about it at the news conference this afternoon, but it's going to be a critical question. Do you side with your vice president? Do you side with your national security advisor? And what do you think about the idea that he may have been misleading people about these conversations?
Yeah,
and adding to Rick's point, this also goes against the one president at a time tradition, and it undercuts American foreign policy and American credibility around the world. We have to revisit how Putin decided not to retaliate to the sanctions imposed by the Obama administration, something that then President-elect Trump applauded publicly.
Yeah. I want to move on to another topic that we reported on yesterday, a poignant story, many would say, about the mother who came to Arizona illegally when she was 14, and she was working in a company. She was rounded up, and it was seen that she had a false Social Security number that she'd used to get that job. But under relatively new at the time Obama administration policy, she was allowed to stay as long as she checked in with the ICE, the immigration officials, every 6 months or so. And she was doing that yesterday when she was detained. Huge protest. She was taken away in a van. And I'm not sure, people thought that she would really be deported. But Enrique, she was sent back to Mexico. Your thoughts on that story?
Well, I think it has to do with a larger narrative of border security. And people need to recognize that the largest factor driving undocumented immigration into the U.S. is not a weak, unprotected border. The border wall is the most expensive, the least effective measure to combat undocumented immigration. And deportations are also the least humane, least effective way to address our immigration crisis. I think we have to look at this from another perspective. Is this mother, Guadalupe Garcia, a threat to our national security, to the well-being of her community? Or now that two young U.S. citizens are left without a mother, is that a problem for society?
These are her teenagers. And we should say today Mexico warned its citizens living in the U.S. to take precautions.
Yeah, and Rick, I want to direct this to you and make the point that I think is very important, because I've spent much of my career and most of my life living along the border. This is exactly what people were hoping Donald Trump would do. It's a big reason why he's in the White House. There was they're calling this woman the first casualty in the shift of administrations, and yet many people would celebrate that.
Well, I think this is a critical point, because for Donald Trump and the way he has cast the border wall as well as the travel ban, it is all about security. And I think he mixes the storylines and talks about the urgent threat. And I think Enrique is very much right in pointing out this is not what people had in mind. But border security, border wall, yes, they did vote for that. Travel ban, yes, they did vote for that. And I think a lot of the outrage that's been aimed at Donald Trump has been in areas where, frankly, he's been making good on campaign promises, which leads to the kind of organizing energy that referenced what happened to Jason Chaffetz at the town hall. That's the backlash, because people are legitimately upset, rightfully upset, about what they see happening when Donald Trump is doing what he said he would do.
Well, let's listen to a little of what happened to Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz. He was at a town hall in his home state of Utah last night. Hundreds of people chanting this. Now, I said earlier today that these were not necessarily his supporters, but they were part of an across-the-country protest movement. And I've been hearing from people in Utah saying, no, these we are his constituents. Many of us who were there are his constituents, and we want him to do his job as House Oversight Committee Chair and investigate Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. Enrique, you take that.
Well, I think it's also bringing more people into the political process. And it's bringing more people into the political process by protesting and being part of this so-called resistance. I think that public pressure is probably the most effective angle on that resistance, because Democrats don't have the numbers to really oppose Republicans in Congress. And this kind of public pressure would, I think, ultimately lead to some results.
Mm-hmm. Rick, you get the last word. Will it work?
I think the energy is unusual, and it is potent. And we saw it work for Republicans in the Tea Party era. It's not clear where this ends up going, but they are being heard. Yeah. And I think the scenes that we're seeing play out across the country will continue at town hall meetings throughout the month of February and beyond. It's real. The energy is out there, and there's something to be done with it.
All right. We'll keep an eye on it. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Enrique Acevedo, Univision news anchor and correspondent. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You may have seen Charlie Sykes' op-ed in this past Sunday's New York Times. He writes, President Trump can repeat falsehoods, say about 3 million people voting illegally, because right-wing media will provide air cover. Charlie was once a member, a popular conservative Wisconsin radio host, but he began to pull out of formation. And just before the Wisconsin primary, he had a blistering interview with then-candidate Donald Trump, excoriating him for, among other things, retweeting an unflattering photo of Ted Cruz's wife.
Is this your standard, that if a supporter of another candidate, not the candidate himself, does something despicable, that it's okay for you personally, a candidate for president of the United States, to behave in that same way? I mean, I expect that from a 12-year-old bully on the playground, not somebody who wants the office held by Abraham Lincoln.
I did a retweet, and it was a retweet by somebody else because I have a lot of support.
Well, Trump won. Sykes lost many of his listeners and left his show, questioning his own role in creating an alternative facts world. Now a conservative MSNBC commentator, he's in a weird purgatory. The right calls him traitor. Left doesn't yet trust him. Charlie Sykes, welcome.
I like that phrase, weird purgatory.
Yes.
Hadn't thought of that.
Well, is that how it feels?
It does, actually. I knew that independent conservatives were going to be in the wilderness after this election. What I didn't realize was that it was going to be such a tiny, tiny island.
Well, do you think your piece in the Times was even seen by the people that you were aiming at? You say the right has been conditioned for decades not to read or trust mainstream media.
And I should, you know, start off by saying that, you know, much of the criticism of the mainstream media was valid. I was surprised to realize that over time, that criticism had been so effective that it had the effect of delegitimizing, completely discrediting the mainstream media and any sort of independent fact-checking. And I have to kind of do a mea culpa and look back on all of that and go, okay, so to what extent did we actually soften up the electorate for what we're experiencing now?
Well, and you say you played a role, you've said this for a while now, in this conditioning of people on the right by hammering mainstream media for bias or for double standards. Bias and double standards people should be hammered for. But what else do you think you did that you now look back on? You are a powerful radio host, as others have said, could make or break careers in Wisconsin.
I was very excited back in the 1990s to realize that we were part of creating an alternative media, that we were moving from a period where a handful of elite media titans sitting in perhaps Manhattan would decide what people would see and what they would talk about. Now, suddenly, you had this proliferation of different voices. And so I really did promote this alternative media, not perhaps aware that it was going to also then at some point morph into an alternative reality silo. I guess I was always assuming that we would be creating an audience that would be savvier, certainly be factually based. What happened, of course, was that we created this echo chamber that has been now exploited by politicians.
But did you ever do more than that? I've listened to a lot of radio all across the dial. There was a right-wing host here in the Boston area who used to talk about killing Muslims, ban immigrants. And then one would call in and say, well, you know, I'm a child of immigrants, but I really like your show. And the host would say, oh, I don't mean you. And these are dog whistles. Did you ever use the dog whistles?
Well, I'm not going to claim innocence, but I do think we had a different sort of talk radio. And I think that's what Donald Trump came up against here in Wisconsin. And he lost very badly in the primary. But as I've learned over the last year, though, all of the incentives in the conservative media have become to become more extreme, to become more reckless. I perhaps was assuming that everybody was pretty much Wisconsin nice like we were, not realizing, you know, all of the years of pounding and pounding and indulgence of crackpot conspiracy theories, how that had really become part and parcel of the conservative movement. I mean, you always knew that there was, you know, the crazy uncle or the drunk at the end of the bar, the birthers and everything. Then you'd roll your eyes and then you just sort of assume that rational voices would prevail. And unfortunately, in the end, they did not.
Well, you call it Wisconsin nice, as you well know. Some of your critics did not feel that way. I'm looking at Jim McKeegan. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, a Watchdog Milwaukee blog. Here's the headline of one of his pieces. Charlie Sykes, adulterer, coward, vindictive Republican shill. And this is about you left one marriage for another. But he felt that that was hypocritical of you because you'd used your show to condemn others.
Well, Jim McKeegan was a former corrupt local official who lost his position during a pension scandal and who was exposed by programs like mine. There's this sort of over-the-top personal rhetoric that I think push people into these different bubbles. This is the kind of politics of personal destruction that I think feeds into the become more extreme, become more radical.
Well, but you have claimed responsibility, if not maybe for that language, for not seeing things as clearly as you're maybe seeing them in hindsight now, which is,
yes,
it is remarkable to watch somebody saying, well, wait a second. And for instance, there were a lot of accusations that Scott Walker's success in Wisconsin, the governor there, had to do with, you know, a hostile racial environment. And there was a 2014 New Republic piece which said that people like you played a role in that hostile environment. And you're quoted as saying in Politico, you know, I hated hearing that, but maybe I have to go back and see if I was.
Yeah, you know, this is one of the things that I'm trying to do this year is to go back and ask that question, you know, engage in kind of that introspection. As much as we didn't like the criticism, was any of it valid? We'd lived in an environment where people were crying wolf all the time. You know, to be a conservative in America was to spend the last 20 years on a routine basis being called, you know, that you're a racist, you're bigoted, you're stupid. If you're for lower taxes, it's because you're a racist. Or if you're in favor of school choice, it's because you're a racist. Here's the problem. When the real thing then finally comes along, the critics have fired all of their ammunition. They are out of rhetoric to describe the real thing.
You mean Donald Trump?
Yes, and many of the people that he enabled, the alt-right in particular.
Well, but what about your fellow at that time right-wing conservative talk show hosts who weren't calling Donald Trump on even, you know, saying that John McCain was a coward for being shot out of the sky? Did you feel kind of naked out there when you started calling out things that you were hearing on the campaign trail, but also on your radio show when you were getting some of these calls from listeners?
I really did get the sense that you know, I was losing some of the audience.
What was it like when some of your listeners did start calling in with some of this seething racism? And
it was somewhat shocking. And I know that some people will think that it's naive that I was shocked. I one time a woman called up and she was endorsing a complete, not a ban on Muslims, but a deportation of Muslims. And she was comparing them to rabid dogs. And I will admit that I was kind of speechless. You know, do we really know who our people are? Do we really understand what our movement was about? That was depressing, and it was disillusioning.
Well, you know, there are some people who do think it's naive or worse. You know, the Wisconsin Democratic chair, Mike Tate, compares you to a guy who slowly fed poison to the dog, and then when the dog dies, says, "How did this happen? Did you really not know that there was a host in Boston who was saying, kill all Muslims, that this was happening?"
Did I know that there were the voices out there? Yes, but I thought they were on the fringes. And I do regret, you know, the birthers, you know, the conspiracy theorists, you know, the people.
Because you were not one of them. You were not one of them.
No, yeah. No, I've never. And in fact, I spent years trying to push back on the fake stuff. This is junk. This is crap. That became harder and harder and harder. They would not accept any source outside of the conservative media ecosystem.
How big is this, Charlie Sykes? In your op-ed this week, you say that the right-wing media is going to provide cover for the president going forward. Where does that ultimately lead, maybe even the right-wing media?
Well, my short answer is I think that everything is going to get worse. I had expected Donald Trump would not be elected and that as a result there would be this reckoning where we would actually have to confront what had happened to the conservative media, the irresponsible media, you know, the sites like InfoWars and Breitbart and Drudge and what Rush Limbaugh had done to conservatism, and that there would be some sort of a sorting out. Instead, as a result of the election, all of those elements have been empowered.
Do you think you're completely alone? I'm thinking of Glenn Beck, who's also come forward with the same concerns and some of the same mea culpas about his role in
yes.
what happened.
I certainly sympathize with that moment where you step back and you go, okay, you know, the baby alligator that we were growing in the bathtub grew up. There are some people for whom there's no mea culpa that I can say, but I think you have to start. Because I think one of the things that's the hardest thing in American politics is to step back and go, you know what? I was wrong about that.
Yeah. Do you worry about getting played by the mainstream media? People will be thrilled to put up the anti-Trump conservative talk show host.
Oh, I completely understand. There's a phrase the conservatives used for years called the strange new respect, that if a conservative, when he became more liberal, got strange new respect. And I certainly understand. But I will tell you this. I actually find it quite liberating to not have to be inside one ideological bubble. There's this tremendous pressure to conform, being able to step back and have an independent point of view and say, okay, I agree with this, but I don't agree with this, as opposed to feeling that I have to take one for the team. I have to defend the indefensible.
You might still be on MSNBC, but be pro-life?
Well, I am on MSNBC and I am pro-life.
Right, right, yeah. Charlie Sykes. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Today, Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, gave the green light to a national referendum on giving him more power. The referendum, if approved by the Turkish people, would be a big win for Erdogan, who's already outmaneuvered and crushed his major foes. An estimated 140,000 people, including journalists, have been arrested, suspended, or dismissed from their jobs since last year's failed coup. The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Istanbul. So, Mark, tell us more about these reforms.
Hello, Robin. Yes, this is a huge change that is being proposed in Turkey's political system, probably the biggest political change in a generation, certainly. It would move Turkey from a parliamentary to presidential republic, so it would scrap the post of the prime minister. The president would be given sweeping new powers, including the right to appoint ministers, prepare the budget, appoint most senior judges, and enact some laws by decree. He'd also be able to dissolve parliament. And parliament would be given limited rights to lead an inquiry into the president or impeach him or her. But really, it makes the president a very, very powerful position. Now, the government and particularly Mr. Erdogan himself say that this would unencumber the president to lead Turkey into a more stable way, in a more stable way, that he would no longer have to clash with another elected official, the prime minister, and that it would the political stability would help Turkey face the kind of terror attacks that have killed over 500 people in the past 18 months. Yeah. But the opposition says that in a country that lacks checks and balances like an independent judiciary and a free press, this would simply entrench President Erdogan's authoritarianism.
But how do the people there feel? There was a fear that Erdogan was making this, what was a secular government, more Islamic. There was that crackdown after the coup attempt, but there have been attacks, so they may be fearful. How do you think the people are going to vote?
Well, really, Turkey is more divided, more polarized perhaps than ever. And it's there for and against Mr. Erdogan himself. He is an immensely powerful, charismatic leader, but he's also a hugely divisive one. He's got half the country behind him, roughly, who really adore him with a reverence that I have not seen anywhere else in an established democracy. And then the other half of the country revile him. Almost can't say his name without spitting. Mm-hmm. And that is how this country is going to vote probably in the referendum. So it will depend on a few thousand or few tens of thousands of votes possibly. The polls suggest that it could be a very, very tight race.
And just briefly, the Trump administration, how might they feel? Turkey, a key ally, helping to fight ISIS. This is a power grab, but we have a president now in this country who's been taking on the judiciary. So what's the thinking there?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting when you compare the two, Robin. President Erdogan and Trump, actually, there are quite a lot of similarities between them, both populist leaders, both of them fairly known for their thin skins, with kind of dubious relationships with the free press, although, of course, here in Turkey, it's much more extreme, with Turkey being the world's biggest jailer of journalists. So we had Mike Pompeo, the head of the CIA, here in Turkey this week on his first overseas visit. So clearly, there is an attempt to have a better relationship between the Trump and Erdogan governments than there was with Barack Obama, with whom relations really soured considerably. And I think that, you know, President Trump is going to see what goes on here in Turkey in the next few weeks leading up to that referendum on the 16th of April.
The BBC's Mark Lowen in Istanbul. Mark, thank you.
Pleasure.
Today, President Trump called last night's Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling against his travel ban a disgraceful decision. And it's not the first time the San Francisco-based court has been accused of overreaching. Many Western Republicans say the Ninth Circuit is too liberal, it's too big, it should be split up. And now there's an effort to do that. A new bill in Congress would break up the Ninth Circuit and create a new 12th Circuit Court of Appeals. The last time a new circuit court was created was all the way back in 1981. Aaron Scharf is a professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University and a former clerk on the Ninth Circuit. Professor Scharf, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So the Ninth Circuit covers 9 Western states. It covers Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands as well. How unique is this court compared to other federal appeals courts around the country?
Look, I think there's no question that the Ninth Circuit is the largest circuit by far. That, I think, is, to me, a real strength of the circuit. As someone who worked for the court and had the privilege of clerking there, the diversity of the jurisdictions the court covered, to me, were always a strength of the circuit and the diversity of perspectives that came on the bench as a result.
Well, Senator Jeff Flake from your home state there in Arizona disagrees. He's just introduced a bill that would split the court up, and he told Fox News this week that Congress has been trying to do this since the 1940s.
It's far too big. It represents 20% of the population of the country. 40% of the land mass is in that jurisdiction. And it's just too big. We have a bedrock principle of swift access to justice. And if you live in Arizona or anywhere in the Ninth Circuit, you just don't have it. 15 months it takes for the average decision to be handed down. And that's far too long.
It sounds like you disagree with Senator Flake.
I don't want to say that I disagree with Senator Flake. I think that there are complications to having a circuit as large as the Ninth Circuit. And I think when you think about what the problems are that Senator Flake has identified and whether or not splitting the circuit is the right solution, time and time again, they've discussed this and sort of said, look, there are other things we could do, right? Right now, if we're concerned about access to justice, there are 4 open seats on the Ninth Circuit that could be filled. And certainly having more judges on open seats would allow swifter access to justice. The efficiency gains of splitting the circuit have never been so clear that every time they deliberate these things, they come back to other ways of dealing with what are some real issues with ensuring that people have swift access to justice.
Well, you mentioned those 4 empty seats. Presumably, President Trump could fill those. They could go to more conservative-leaning judges. But, you know, the court also has a reputation for being very liberal. Some people will call it the Nutty Ninth or the Ninth Circus. You worked there. Do you think the reputation's fair?
The Ninth Circuit gets a lot of controversial cases, and those are the ones that get the headlines. But most of the cases the Ninth Circuit hands down aren't heard by the Supreme Court aren't reversed. The vast majority of cases are dealt with expeditiously and are not controversial. And there's a real value in having consistency in federal law across the circuit.
So, and I'm just looking at some of the past cases that have made headlines in the Ninth Circuit that have not been popular with Republicans. There was a ruling against Don't Ask, Don't Tell that covered gays in the military, of course. It ruled that the phrase under God in the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. And then in 2011, I remember this, I was there in Arizona, it upset many people there when it ruled against key parts of the state's immigration law known as SB 1070. So are you saying that Republicans are using those sorts of things as chum, essentially, to create the argument against the Ninth Circuit?
I think that there are real concerns about efficiency, but I also have some concerns. Look, the judicial nominations process in this country has been broken for a very, very long time. And I worry that this new circuit debate is another attempt for the political branch to make more partisan what I think is one of our finest democratic institutions, our independent judiciary. And not everyone is going to agree with any Ninth Circuit ruling on any given day or maybe over the course of a year. But the Ninth Circuit's judges are wonderfully talented, diverse people who are unafraid to write majorities and dissents and weigh in on the critical issues of the day.
I take your point that changing the way we appoint judges maybe would help the system become more efficient in the Ninth Circuit. But just looking at Senator Flake's plan that would create a new 12th Circuit, what do you make of his argument that cutting back that caseload would speed things up and that would be a good thing?
I think it really depends on how many judges are assigned to the new 12th Circuit and the former 9th Circuit, because what really determines caseload is the number of judges that can hear cases and the number of staff members that can schedule those cases in an expeditious fashion. So it can't be just the case that splitting up 100 cases into two groups of 50 cases is going to allow us to hear these cases more quickly. Senator John Kyle, who was our former Senator John Kyle, was really thoughtful about these issues for a number of years. And he sort of said, you know, when you think about what the challenges are of the Ninth Circuit, California is really the elephant in the room. They hear, something like 60% of civil cases
the Ninth Circuit hears are
coming from California. So as you think about splitting up the Ninth Circuit, what efficiency gains are there to separate California from the rest of the Ninth Circuit?
And it will be interesting to watch this because, of course, Donald Trump is a Republican in the White House and Republicans control Congress now. So there may be changes ahead for the Ninth Circuit. Aaron Scharf is a professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University, also a former law clerk on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
If you've got a clear sky tonight, it might be worth a look up, because along with February's full moon, which is being called the snow moon, there will be two other major events, a deep penumbral lunar eclipse and the pre-dawn flyby of the Green Comet. So let's go to our expert on all things space, Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope. Kelly, welcome back.
Hey, Peter. Hi.
Hey, so let's start with this penumbral eclipse. If I'm remembering my high school Latin appropriately, this has something to do with a shadow. I guess all eclipses have something to do with a shadow. What is it?
That's right. And lunar eclipses always take place at a full moon. So this is a kind of a tease lunar eclipse. It's not a deep, dark one. No blood moon this time. If you look up in the sky at about 7:45 Eastern time, you can make the time zone correction accordingly, you'll see that there's a kind of dusky shading on the full moon on the top or maybe the left-hand side, depending on where it is in your sky. And that is the moon going, just skirting the shadow of the Earth, not going through the dark core, but from the sort of skirting, how do I describe it? Yeah. If you were standing on the moon, you would see the sun partially covered by the Earth. So it's kind of, it's not really even a major eclipse, but it's something that will occupy you. You'll know that something is wrong with the moon.
Still interesting.
Yes.
Okay. So speaking of full moons, I've heard something or read something recently that I thought was pretty cool. every full moon has a name. Is that right?
That's right. More than one in a lot of cases. Sure.
Where does that come from?
So when the pilgrims and other colonists landed here, they encountered the Algonquin Indians, which stretch out to Lake Superior from New England. And they had their calendar was marked by the passages of full moons. And they gave each one a name so that they could sort of keep track. So the snow moon, obviously, it's in February when the most snow falls.
Feels really right.
Yeah.
Right
the,
now.
The one in January is called the wolf moon because that's when wolves were often heard to howl with hunger. The one in March is called the worm moon because that's when the ground starts to get soft and worms start appearing. So there's a sort of nature connection here. And these Algonquin tribes conveyed those names to the pilgrims and the colonists, and they sort of stuck. And so that's where those names came from.
We still use them. Okay, what about this comet? The green comet is on its way. We're going to be able to see it, I suppose, very early in the morning, right?
Yeah, Peter, I have a secret for you. Most comets are green. And you can't see it by eye because your eyes at night don't really see color very well. That green color comes from something called diatomic carbon, which is being given off by the comet, the icy comet nucleus. And this comet has a really long name, Honda Mercos Pajusakova. And I won't ask you to say that three times, but those are the people who discovered it back in 1948. And this comet is coming by about 8 million miles away from the Earth, not particularly close. And honestly, it's not very bright. I went out to look for it this morning. I could not find it in binoculars. Just know that it's out there and whizzing by at about 51,000 miles an hour.
Okay, well, I'm probably going to be asleep, but other people can take a look. Kelly Beatty, senior editor at Sky and Telescope, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Among the nominees up for a Grammy Award on Sunday is a surround sound album created by a student at Berklee College of Music in Boston. Craig Hella Johnson's composition is titled Considering Matthew Shepard. Shepard was the gay college student beaten and abandoned in a field outside Laramie, Wyoming in 1998. He died 6 days later. While his murder led to the enactment of anti-hate crime legislation, controversial questions have been raised about whether his death was the result of a drug deal gone bad. The story Johnson tells in his choral work channels his own emotional response to Shepard's death. Andrea Shea from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
Considering Matthew Shepard begins with Craig Hella Johnson playing this simple Bach piano prelude. But then it shifts tone with a cowboy's yodel.
So sings the lone cowboy.
Soon, members of Johnson's Grammy-winning choral ensemble Conspirare set a bucolic scene, singing of sky, cattle, horses, and grass.
Sky, cattle, horses.
But inevitably comes tragedy, with details about what two men who were eventually convicted of murder did to Matthew Shepard in 1998.
Near midnight, they drove him to a remote area, tied him to a split rail fence, beat him horribly, and left him to die in the cold of night.
Johnson says he'll never forget learning about Shepard's death.
In that moment, it was a piercing for me. I remember it vividly, even almost in my body still. And then what happened in the weeks and months after his death, too, created such a big space in me. I was a regular gay kid growing up in the Midwest. All of a sudden, I thought, oh my gosh, here it is. The hatred that I had felt as a gay person suddenly had such a focused, incredibly tragic story here in Matt that became this catalyst for me to feel even more deeply. And I think it opened me up.
As a choral composer, Johnson says he felt compelled to respond the way he knows how, through music and words. To tell Shepard's story respectfully, Johnson reached out to Judy Shepard, Matthew's mother. She gave the project a green light, even though in the past that hasn't always been the case with other artists who've been moved to respond to her son's death.
Candidly, it's really hard. You feel like you want the Matt you know to be represented, and so rarely is that the case. It's an interpretation of who they think Matt is. So we've really officially endorsed very, very few projects. And this was one of them because we just felt that Craig had a real feel for who Matt was.
To paint a portrait, Johnson set some of Matt's writings to music. Judy Shepard admits she's avoided listening to the recording in its entirety, but she has allowed herself to hear the movement titled Ordinary Boy.
I only heard it by itself and it just tore me up because it was Matt's words. And Matt Alber, who sings that particular piece, was spectacular.
I am funny, sometimes forgetful, and messy. And lazy.
Makes him feel real to you, doesn't it?
Matt Alber, who sings the part of Matthew, agrees.
It feels incredibly healing to hear the story, even knowing how difficult it is to listen to it.
Alber also sings tenor in the chorus and plays the yodeling cowboy. Like composer Craig Johnson, he says he also struggled as a gay youth and connected with Shepard.
Craig has told us many times that he felt like he got a message from Matt when he was composing it that says, "Don't leave me on the fence."
The fence that Shepard was tied to and tortured on for 18 hours before he died plays the role of innocent bystander in Johnson's composition. The lyrics come from Holyoke, Massachusetts writer Leslie Newman's collection of poems for Shepard, titled October Morning.
I held him.
Composer Craig Hella Johnson hopes the Grammy nomination and possible win will help his ode to Shepard reach a broader audience.
This was really, at its most simplest, just a song for Matt. You know, it ended up being a 107-minute song, but his death shook me to the core and moved me deeply, and I wanted to sing a song back.
And in considering Matthew Shepard, Johnson and his ensemble do just that.
What could be the song we'll begin again? Who could meet us there? Where might we begin?
For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Rise to sing again. Where could be the joy?
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.